The reason that we talk about prophecy is because Yahweh uses it to prove that he authored, that he inspired, that he spoke through these prophets, these scribes, whom we find in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. It really is the most intelligent approach God could possibly use. Now, I'm prejudiced here. I rather like him, and I would be prone to look at something that he does as favorable. I rather like the universe that he created. I rather like life. I rather enjoy my life. I'm impressed with what he had to say in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms. I like him as an individual. I respect him as the creator. And so, I'm prejudiced. I'm going to admit. But as I think about it, I think that prophecy is the perfect tool for him to deploy to prove that he authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, to prove that you can trust it. Because he had a number of different options to use to accomplish that. He could have revealed very complex scientific and perhaps just scientific is the word I'm looking for, and leave it there. Evidences that were, and even though he did, in my view, do these kinds of things, where he could have talked about, there's going to be a finding sometime in your future about DNA, and it's going to be the language that I use to conceive life. Could have talked about the Cambrian explosion as proving that his testimony on the conception of life was accurate. He could have spoken about E equals MC squared and what that means in terms of his promise to empower us relative to light. And although he spoke all around these things, he could have used scientific jargon, perhaps, although there weren't words for it in Hebrew at the time. The problem with that would have been that the message would not have done anyone any good until the last, 30 or 40, 50 years. So at that point, what he's saying is not only irrelevant, it would be counterproductive to convey for much of the past 5,000 years and really only be valued, or 6,000 years, only be valued to people in the last 50 years. And so that's probably not the best approach. He could talk all around it, which he did, to make statements that help us appreciate the influence of science and his understanding of science, and he did that. But that was not the right way to go. He attempted knowing that it wouldn't work, but at least wanted to deploy it to demonstrate to us that it wasn't the best way to go, that when the children of Israel were coming out of Mitzrayim, the realm of human political and religious oppression, Yahweh not only provided a summary copy of his teaching on the two tablets. That didn't work real well because Moshe broke them. He provided a second set. But he actually spoke to the children of Israel everything that he has conveyed to Moshe in his Torah. He gathered them all together and says, I'm going to talk to you about this. And he has a relatively booming voice. And the entire top of the mountain of Mount Horeb was ablaze with his light. And in a booming voice, he articulated everything that we read in the Torah, at least up through Devarim. And the children of Israel said, whoa, man, I mean, it's overwhelming. I mean, gosh, cut us some slack. It was overwhelming. And they begged Yahweh to stop doing it. It would be just like today if every place in the world, say every circle of 100 miles where anyone lived around the world, that Yahweh represented himself on the highest ground with this blazing light and was constantly booming out his instructions to everyone, drowning out, of course, television, and drowning out radio, and God forbid, and drowning out the internet, and drowning out everybody's voice, just so the only thing that anyone could hear was the big, booming voice of God. Now, not only did the people, even the children of Israel, hate it, it was way too much for them. And Yahweh acknowledged, said, I understand, I get it. So I'm going to communicate to you through a diminished corporeal manifestation. I'm going to represent myself next time through a man. But if God did that, would there really be any choice? I mean, how would you choose to ignore God if he were doing that? How would you go about corrupting what he said, convoluting what he said to create a religious alternative if God himself is talking to you? You can't do it. There is no political or religious alternative. And if God is doing that, then he is not in a position where he's going to tolerate malfeasance in his midst. So if somebody becomes militaristic, he's going to have to swat them. If someone becomes religious, he's going to have to do away with them. And so all of a sudden now there's no free will. If there's no free will, what's the purpose of offering the covenant? And so that doesn't work either. God could position himself silently as big as the universe, but we wouldn't know what he was offering, and so that wouldn't do any good. God could remove free will and make everybody little miniature robots that do exactly what he wants us to do. But what fun would that be? How would he get anything out of that? Where would the choice be? How could there be any love? So when you look at it, prophecy really was the most effective tool because he could report future history and the past for all time. He could tell people what was going to happen tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, 10 years hence, 100 years hence, 400 years hence, 1,000, 2,000, and 7,000. And so for every generation, there was something that they could use to say, yeah, exactly what he said was going to happen, happened. And it always happens. He's never wrong. He always manages to tell us what's going to happen before it does. And you can run, probabilities. After you've done it enough time, you look at what he has said was going to occur and what actually occurred. And one of the greatest really is the last visit of Yahweh in the form of Yahusha, where there are many hundreds of exacting predictions of what he was going to do, what he was going to say, where he was going to do it, when he was going to do it, what the consequence of all this was going to be. And all of it is recorded in the Qumran scrolls, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, some 200 years before these things occurred, some even 300 years before they occurred. So you've got in writing, in fact, in Daniel, you have in writing exactly when he's going to arrive, predicted 500 years before his arrival, on the exact date that he's going to arrive and where he's going to arrive on that date. And so when these things occur consistently as predicted, you can run the probability. What's the chance of that happening just because Daniel or a sheep herder in Western Arabia, and Moshe, got lucky, guessed right, pretended to be Nostradamus. I took 25 prophecies when I was writing my first book on Islam, Tea with Terrorists. And I just ran the chance fulfillment of 25 prophecies related to the Masiyah, Yahusha, the arrival of the individual that Christians errantly call Jesus Christ. And of those 25 prophecies, the combined likelihood that they occurred just because the predictor got lucky and guessed right was 1 to 10 to the 56th power. There aren't 10 to the 56th power molecules in the entire known universe. Prophecy proves God's existence. If you're an atheist, if you're an agnostic, and you say, I'm not going to believe in a God that I can't prove exists, there's your chance. It's the value of logic. It's the value of probability. Everything that we do mathematically to prove something, everything we do scientifically to prove something is based on this exact same concept, the probability. Consistent outcomes. God proves that he exists and that he authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms by consistently offering detailed, absolutely correct reports of future history. Now, I want to make one other point before we go into this testimony, because it has a prophetic element to it in Bereshit 15:13. God is not predicting the future. He is reporting the future in our past. He is not predestining us to that future. He is instead reporting the culmination of our bad choices. You see, as light, time simply exists, just like the Hebrew language, where the verbs simply exist in time. They're not tethered to the past, the present, or the future, as we are in our mortal state, as any piece of matter is. God's light, and as light, he witnesses the past, present, and future as if they were collectively now. He has witnessed our future. He has witnessed the consequence of our choices. He's witnessed the United States acting stupidly in Iraq, leading to the Syrian Civil War, and that being a catalyst for World War III, which is why he reported on it in our past, warning us about it. He's seen what we have done to ourselves. And he's reporting in our past what he has seen. There's no prediction here at all. God is right because he's reporting future history, because he's an eyewitness. Now, once you recognize that you can prove God's existence through prophecy, if you just care to investigate the evidence and apply logic and probability to it, the next important step is to say, all right, since God proved that he exists, he demonstrates that his name is Yahweh, he has absolutely validated the claim that he inspired and authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, who is he? What is he like? What does he want? What is he offering? How do we capitalize upon it? And that is the purpose of this program. We'll be back in a moment. So now reading what God said, and then he, Yahweh, affirmed, to approach and be near Abram, you must know with absolute certainty, yada yada, that indeed, as a foreigner living and traveling as a temporary inhabitant, your seed, your offspring, will exist in a land which is not for them, and they will serve as slaves. And then they will respond, and they will seek resolution accordingly in 400 years. Now, it's important that we recognize that Yahweh asked Abraham to leave Babylon before he could engage in a covenant. God wants us to walk away from, disassociate from, religious and political, militaristic and economic institutions that are nationalized schemes. Babylon remains God's least favorite. He not only details everything he despises about Babylon, even when Babylon was not even a country anymore, but the end of the prophetic witness in Revelation ends with Yahweh just prior to his return saying, "Come out of Babylon, my people." That symbolically, Babylon, what it represents is the influence of religion and politics, militarism, and jaundiced economic schemes. God said, don't associate from them, disassociate from them, particularly if you want to participate in my covenant. Well, there was a place that God disliked almost as much as Babylon. That place was Egypt. He called it Mitzrayim. He called it the crucible. Actually, Mitzrayim is crucibles, because it represented two crucibles. One is human interference, military, political, religious interference in people's lives. The crucible of slavery, of works-based religious and political schemes for just person survival. The other crucible was it represents the crucible of divine judgment, where God does judge those things. And so God is saying here that in that environment, you don't belong. You're a stranger there. If you're going to be a member of the covenant, if you're going to participate in the covenant, you need to be a stranger there. And we've talked about this from every possible side. But it's important that folks recognize that if God allowed religion and politics and militarism and patriotism into his home, then heaven would be no different than earth. All of the hellish things that we experience here with our military schemes and with our just degrading political schemes and despicable religious institutions, all of the things that have caused so much pain and suffering on earth would just continue on forever in heaven if God allowed them. So they aren't allowed. That's why the first thing you need to do if you want to participate in the covenant, if you want to engage in God's family, if you want to be his kid, is you have to say, I don't want to be part of those things anymore. I'm disassociating with them so I can associate with you. And so God is telling us that unless you are an alien, a foreigner, in these political and religious militaristic realms, that you're not a member of his family. So the offspring of the covenant will be foreigners there, just as they should be foreigners here in America, just as they should be foreigners no matter where they live in the world as it relates to the institutions of man. Why? Because man enslaves. And enslaves through either communist or fascist regimes in today's world. Most religious malfeasance is through fascism. Almost all of the Islamic states are fascist. But, you know, communism it has many fascist qualities. You look at Hitler, it was the Nazi, was the German Socialist Workers' Party. Fascism and communism, very, very similar beasts. And they enslave. You look at Europe during the dominion of the Roman Catholicism, and what you had is a feudal system. People had no rights, they had no property. They had no wealth, no freedom. That's where we're headed. That's where we have been. Enslaved by religious and political institutions. America is now becoming ever more fascist, ever more socialistic, ever more militaristic, and freedoms are eroding every day. That's where we're headed. We ought not associate with these things. We ought to view ourselves as a foreigner. And that's why we talk about when God says walk away from these things, he's not saying that we walk from America to Mexico. What he's saying is that we disassociate from them, that we're a foreigner living in these places. That's precisely what he said here. We'll return to the concept of 400 years. After the break, 400 years of servitude in Egypt was a trial for Yahweh's wayward children. And it occurred because the Egyptians were overtly political and religious, blending the two together. And it also provided the benefit wrought by Abraham's seed, by Yahweh, on Abraham's seed, because God was able to rescue his people from human bondage and servitude. God was able to liberate them. That's the Torah's purpose, is to liberate us from human oppression. It is to free us from the derivative of religious, political, economic, and military malfeasance. These things known, let's turn our attention to the one making the sojourn, the one living and traveling as a temporary inhabitant who was Abraham's seed descendant, is seen existing in a land, country, and realm which was not for them. This peculiar treatment was designed to distinguish Yosef, meaning Yahweh increases by uniting, known as Joseph, from the masses which became the children of Yisrael. There are so many aspects of Yosef's life which mirror Yahusha's that Yosef was just used as a prophetic portrait for the Messiah. God does this routinely, but one of the most vivid of these depictions is through Yosef. Now, to fully appreciate these similarities, a brief history is in order. Now, and I'm focusing here on Yosef because Yosef went into Egypt as a solitary individual. He was, we'll get into how that occurred. And he so endeared himself to the Egyptians that he was able to save his own people, the Israelites, whom some had turned on him, to save them from a growing famine in the region. He became the most powerful person, second only to the Pharaoh in Egypt. His agrarian reforms, his storehouses, his tracking of the Nile River's flooding, and the insights that he received from Yahweh regarding feast and famine in Egypt made him the second most powerful person in the country, second only to the Pharaoh. And so there was a period of time where the children of Israel were welcomed guests for about 40 years in Egypt. And then after Yosef's passing, the Egyptians turned on them and made them slaves. And it is in the story of Yosef we see so many similarities to the Messiah Yahusha that what we see is a prototype for him, a prophetic picture that just adds to God using so many different ways to tell us the same story. And so let's talk about some of what occurred, this brief history, if you will. Yosef's early ordeals, as well as his triumphant life in Egypt, dominate the final one-third of the book known as Bereshith. That's the first of the five or six books that comprise the Torah. The Torah is Bereshith is the first book. Shemoth, which means names, is the second book. Bereshith means in the beginning. We move on to the book of Kara, which is invitations to read and to recite, invitations to meet with God through reading and reciting is the book of Kara. It's been changed to Leviticus, which means nothing, which takes us to in the wilderness, Bamidbar, in the place where the word was not considered, which is why the children of Israel wandered for 40 years. And it concludes, depending on your interpretation, either with Dabarim, which means words, or with Yahusha, who was Moshe's successor, who tells us that he completed the Torah. Well, in the first book, the last one-third of the first book focuses on this one individual, Yosef, and his early ordeals, as well as his triumphant life in Egypt. It begins in the 37th chapter and continues through the end of the book with Yaakov and Yosef's death, beginning around 50. As the story unfolds, Yahweh is shown being compassionate towards Rachel, meaning loved and compassionate lamb of God, responding to her cry by opening, patah, freeing and releasing her womb, enabling her to give birth to Yosef. He became Yaakov's most beloved son through a miraculous intervention by God, causing his brothers to be a bit jealous. Their scheme was to do away with him, and it led to Yosef being sold as a slave to a group of Midianite, read Arabian, caravanners en route to Egypt. Now, to hide their crime, the brothers dipped the young boy's coat of many colors in lamb's blood to fool their father, Yaakov, Abraham's grandson, into thinking that his son had been killed. At 17, Yosef worked as a slave in the home of the commander of Pharaoh's guard. There, Potiphar's wife made amorous advances toward him, which he rebuffed, causing her to level false accusations of sexual harassment against him. So Yosef was sent to prison. And while in an Egyptian jail, Yosef befriended two prisoners, the Pharaoh's cupbearer and a royal baker, ultimately predicting their futures by interpreting their dreams. When the cupbearer was released and returned to duty, he overheard Pharaoh complain that no one understood his dream. The servants told the king about the Hebrew prisoner who had accurately predicted his release. And as a result, Yosef was then summoned to the palace, where he promptly told Pharaoh that his vision of seven fat cows coming out of the Nile being eaten by seven lean cows, who would also arise from the river, was an indication that the annual rise of the Nile would bring seven bumper crops followed by 7 years where plants would not grow. Famine. Impressed, Pharaoh appointed Yosef vizier of Egypt. Yosef married Asenath, the daughter of the high priest, who had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. As the new de facto leader of what the Egyptians called the Black Land, and with foreshadowing of what would occur, Yosef instituted agrarian reform, whereby the nation's feudal system was replaced by collectivization, making land and food the property of the state. A central administration was established, and grain was both collected and doled out. And as a result of the accuracy of his prediction and the role he played serving and saving the Egyptian people, Yosef became exceedingly powerful, ultimately building a palace for his family at Avaris, the future capital of Goshen. The story ends with Yosef's brothers, along with their families and livestock, heading to the Nile Delta as a result of a regional climate-induced famine. And while they were allowed to settle in Goshen, Jacob's other sons did not recognize the brother they had sold into slavery years before. Initially, we are told that Yosef held them accountable for their crime, but ultimately he forgave them, reuniting father and son. Both, however, passed away soon thereafter. But Yosef's mummified body, per his instructions, was carried back to the promised land during the Exodus. Now, before we examine the similarities between Yosef and Yahusha, it should be noted that virtually every aspect of the Torah's account that I have just shared with you, right down to the coat of many colors, the massive agrarian reforms, Egypt's ensuing rise in prominence, and even the foundations of Yosef's home, his palace, have been confirmed by archaeological digs conducted over the past 2 years. Even the determination of the 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of drought, we have the records on the canyons and through which the Nile flowed, that exactly at the time that Yosef was promoted to the vizier of Egypt, that there were seven ideal rises of the Nile that were perfect for plentiful crops, followed by 7 years of disastrous famine. Every aspect of the story is affirmed. And now, the likelihood that an ancient book would be right scientifically and historically, when everything else that exists during this time that was written at a similar time is nothing but a hodgepodge of mythological stories. You know, even the Iliad, while it has some basis in fact, is still all woven together with myths. Not this. Every aspect of the story occurred exactly as God has told us. The fact is that the evidence that has been conducted over the past decades confirm the Torah's validity. The evidence is ubiquitous. It is irrefutable. Now, the long list of parallels between the lives of Yosef and Yahusha begins with recognizing that God intervened personally and assisted in both births. Bar-Rashith 30:22-24, and Mataniah 1:18-23. Yosef was the most beloved son of the father. Both men tended their father's sheep. Both acted as servants. Yosef and Yahusha went to Egypt in their youth to avoid being killed. Both of their families were called out of Egypt by God. Each resisted very enticing temptations. These men began their ministries around 30 years of age. They were hated by their kinsmen because they were superior to them. And of course, they were filled with the Spirit. Both fed their people. In the final moments before he was murdered for his devotion to Yahusha, Stephen drew this specific comparison between Yosef and Yahusha. This was his speech as recorded in Acts 7, 9-14. The record of Yosef's role is memorialized in Bereshith 41, 47. When we return to the last segment of Shattering Mist today, we'll continue by sharing the parallels between Yosef and Yahusha and what it means to us. We'll be back in a moment. Speaking of the comparison between Yosef and Yahusha, one serving as a model for the other. Now, you can't make a direct comparison because Yosef was a prototype as a model. Yahusha was the set-apart and diminished corporeal manifestation of Yahweh. But there are so many of these similarities that help prophetically present through Yahusha, through Yosef, what we should expect and the world should have expected from Yahusha. So, from Yosef to Yahusha, the brethren of both men conspired to kill them, and both were sold out for money, each for the price of a slave. Yosef was sold to the Egyptians on the advice of his brother, Yahudah, Judah. Yosha was abandoned to the Romans by his disciple, Judas. Yosef didn't say a word to his brothers when they sentenced him to a life of slavery, and Yosha was silent as his trial. As with Yosef, Yosha was rejected by his brethren, and he was convicted of crimes he did not commit on the testimony of false witnesses. Both were imprisoned unjustly. Two other prisoners suffered alongside them. In both cases, one prisoner would be condemned while the other would be released. This portion of the Messiah's life parallel the account that is vividly presented here in Bereshith. If you want to know who Yahusha is, read the Torah. Yosef forgave his brethren and reconciled himself to them, as did Yahusha. The Messiah said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." When Mary announced Yahusha's return to his disciples, they did not believe her. Likewise, Jacob did not believe his sons when they told him that Yosef was alive. It reads, "He was stunned because he did not trust him." Bereshith 45:26. Moshe collected Yosef's bones from his tomb and removed them from Egypt, seeing to it that they were brought back into the promised land. Just as Yahweh returned Yosef's soul from the place of separation and brought him home. Yosef was neither God nor Savior, yet his life reflected the nature of God and was prophetic of the Savior. Therefore, rather than one prophetic statement, by transitioning from the single sojourner to the multitudes, God provided us with three relevant predictions whose fulfillments would serve to validate his promises, and that was the purpose of this declaration. Even more telling, Yahusha, the singular descendant of Abraham, the one who enabled the covenant's blessings, the one who became a temporary inhabitant in our world, explains why the meanings of Ana are so divergent. The word, as we learned yesterday, that can mean respond, answer, or to be afflicted. You see, Yahweh's answer was to afflict himself so we wouldn't be afflicted. Yosef voluntarily suffered the consequence of the violation of the provisions Yahweh had established, and he endured the penalties described therein, so that those of us who actually commit these infractions, but who otherwise heed the terms and conditions of the covenant, wouldn't have to suffer the same fate. So in this way, Yahusha is Yahweh on his knees. Yahusha is Anna, bowing down and diminishing himself to serve us. God Anna humbled himself, not only in the process of taking on human form, becoming at least part of himself, diminished in material form, but he became our servant to serve us, to serve our interest. We, Anna, mistreated him, Anna afflicting him on Pesach. And yet, in spite of what we had done to Anna denigrate him, he allowed his soul to Anna be downcast into Sheol, separating himself from Yahweh on unleavened bread. And yet, all God expects of us is to Anna answer and respond to his invitation, to his summons, to meet with him and be called out during these seven opportunities to read and recite his testimony, to meet with him, to Anna to seek answers and resolution by way of his witness and testimony. We can learn so much when we consider the words, when we put them in context, when we come to understand the entire story. Look forward to being with you at this time tomorrow. May Yah bless.